A healthy life starts with great sleep. Wake refreshed with Avocado's GOTS-certified organic green mattress, delivering breathable, back-loving support, natural materials from Avocado's own sustainable wool and latex farms, easy financing, a one-year sleep trial, and deep, restorative slumbers. Organic sleep awaits at avocadomattress.com.
Action. Give me your best stuff. Come on, give me your master. Fine.
Darling.
I have not had a chance to like really go for it because I'm just like, haven't had time. I can't tell you, I have not had time to do anything, to not take care of myself. I don't have time.
Do you ever think it's nice to not have time? I sometimes like not having time.
I think I would feel good if I felt like I was getting everything I needed to get done. Which
just
like,
sometimes I don't mind being a robot, you know?
I don't mind. I think it's like ramping up to this UK tour. We just spent like £7,000 on it, marketing. Like, it's like just I don't know where my money is. I don't know where money is going. And I know I have to do taxes. And like, do I have to? Yes. Do I want to? No. I really don't want to is the thing.
I did it. It was, I don't recommend it. Actually.
Let me rub my eyes a little.
Oh. Can I tell you that the show has gone so well much fun?
Tell me everything. That's really exciting.
Well, you know, it's choose your own adventure. And so the audience like affects how the show ends and stuff. And it's like I had some friends come this weekend on Saturday and on Sunday and they had two totally different shows. And it was just it's all improv driven and it's so fun.
Oh.
And we've gotten like 4 reviews, all really good. And we're up for 2 Emmys, which the Emmys are...
I have to vote for it right now. Hold on, let me do it one.
Yeah, vote for us. The Emmys are like, you know, immersive awards, and we're up for the best immersive in New York and the Audience Choice Award, and we're up against, like, U2 did something immersive this year, and Netflix did, like, a Squid Game thing. We're, like, up against them for the audience thing. And I'm like, that's so funny.
That's so good. I don't...
Good company. It's just
an honor to be nominated. You can actually say that.
It's just an honor just to be nominated.
Verification email?
Yeah.
Hold on. It's just my email, right?
Yeah.
Vote for yourself with Truly Darkly Creeply?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Reader Special Award. Okay, wait, what am I doing? Order of Golden Scribe. Oh my God, you're nominated against it. That's so good. Squid Game? Oh my God.
Because they did an interactive Squid Game thing. Netflix did.
This is so good. Okay, submit. Great. My response has been recorded. I hope you get it. I hope you win against U2 and Netflix. You know I do.
Yeah.
That's just really cool. Quinn,
it's really
fun. Probably feels so good too. And I feel this way in a lot of situations where it's like you and I both create a lot of work for ourselves. Like we write our own shows, we perform in them, we do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It must feel so fucking incredible to do a show that you had very little to do in its inception.
Absolutely.
It feels so good.
And it's also
conception,
been really
I'm thinking.
Cool.
Very little in the conception of the show.
Yes. It also just feels really good because I lost my hair tie.
It's in your hair.
It feels really I know, but I had another. I know. It's in my hair. I'm gonna kill you. It feels really good because I feel so inspired by the job that Arlo Howard is the writer who works for Punch Drunk, and they did such an amazing job crafting this piece, and I'm like blown away by it. And my producer Shry is like so like kind and like makes space for everybody and is working her ass off and shows up early and is like having to transform a theater space into a working restaurant that serves like a tea and is like following all the food protection stuff and like
wow
hired staff to do that and it's wild to be in a situation like this. I've never been in one like this where it is a working restaurant that is working completely in conjunction with a theatrical production, and we are queuing each other, and there's stage managers, and there's people that are front of house and back of house and pouring water, and it's like everybody having to do this thing and work together is really, every day that we do it, I'm like, we did it again. That was so cool. I can't believe that worked. Yeah, it's so fabulous.
I'm really stoked you're doing this.
Yeah, it's been like a really good comeback from the trip and like have all these cool things. And then last night, something really awesome happened, which was that Spencer and Adam had just gotten back from a trip. And so Adam was tie-tie, and they had tickets to Illinois. Have you heard?
I'm dying to see it. I'm absolutely...
And Spencer took me because Adam didn't want to go. So Spencer took me last night.
How was it?
It was so cool. It was incredible. It's like, you know, his music.
Yeah, it's Sufjan Stevens. Oh, I love Illinois. Is a great album.
I'm not cool, and I don't know cool things. And I had no idea. And so... meeting the music, but then having it brought to life by like modern ballet dancers, essentially, yeah, that are doing like a narrative ballet. Oh, it was so cool.
It Wait, really so cool. I
and
should
I'd
see
never
it.
Even I'm... been to the Park Avenue Armory before, oh, and that was so cool.
That's really cool. I worked in that place, which sucks. Is like a football field. I catered there and it was terrible.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
I think I might buy tickets for when I'm home for that week. I should buy tickets for this thing.
You should. It was really beautiful. Like, really beautiful. And it's my favorite, which is to say 90 minutes, no intermission.
Ooh. Ooh. Party.
That is a chef's kiss from me instantly.
I hear that. I smell
that. That's how you do it, folks.
And folks.
You lose me at an intermission. I'm just too tired. Don't make me stop. Let's, like, get through this.
I gotta get through this. I am in Wichita, the home of the BTK, right now.
Yikes.
Yipes. And then guess where we're staying? Oh, I have to tell you this. This is really cool. Guess where I'm staying when I'm in Milwaukee?
I have no idea.
I've stayed there before, but I'm staying at this place called the Ambassador Hotel, which is where Jeffrey Dahmer killed one of his victims.
Oh, why do you always stay there? It's your favorite thing.
I've stayed there. It's like
they want to loop it into the narrative of the tour.
Our expert wanted to stay there. She's obsessed with Jeffrey Dahmer, so she wanted to stay there. But I had stayed there before. It's like this really cool Art Deco hotel. It's not the nicest, but it's cool. It's a little creepy. It's cool. It's outside of Milwaukee. I'm really excited to go to Milwaukee. I'm excited for Cheese Curds and Spotted Cow, but I'm also so excited to see my family. Like it's like real world. You're like three strangers picked to live in a van.
Down by the river
and just like hope it goes well. And so like a lot of dynamics, like you just and like you're traveling the country with people you don't know and you just like hope everybody's cool. It's very weird. I'm excited to have some familiarity because sometimes being on the road with people you don't know is just like it just makes me feel like I don't think I could ever be in an arranged marriage. But like, imagine being like thrown in.
Which was totally something you were planning for the year. Well, honestly, so I guess you're giving that up.
Honestly,
now.
At this point, why not? At this point, what have I got to lose, frankly? But I feel like it is like, it's just unnatural to be thrown in to a month-long, everyday interaction with people who you've never met before and that somebody else, the producers, are matchmaking. It's like a very weird feeling.
Question.
It's weird. Have you ever toured before like that?
No, I never would.
Why wouldn't you? You hate people.
I think I would get homesick.
Yeah.
I like really need to feel... I like travel a lot, but I still feel a little homesick sometimes on trips. I like, and I just think if I can only travel based on the fact that I do it with people that negate the homesickness feeling.
Yeah. That's
so
a very good
point. So if it
was
a match of I don't know the place or the people, it would be a little too overwhelming.
Yeah. I think it's felt like that at times for me, sure. But I feel like because I'm the seasoned pro compared to the person our one guy is well seasoned, but like, it does sometimes feel like a thankless job.
Yeah.
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 And it's a challenge. But
do you guys eat together?
I pick up food for everybody. So it's like, it's just a lot of logistics. But sometimes we do. I tend to avoid it. Like, what I'm working on right now is being like, I need alone time. Like, I love alone time. I'm like an introverted extrovert, or I'm extroverted introvert. I don't know what it is, but I need alone time to recharge. And so, like, I'll pick up food and I'll be like, I'm going into my dressing room and closing the door. But some of these places, there's no door. And you can't get alone. Like, that's what's hard. Mm-hmm. So I've been like sitting in a car. I've taken like long trips to Target.
That's good. I love Target.
Yeah. I know it very intimately at this point. I know, like, you put me in a Target, I'll find my way around very easily.
Yeah.
And I'm also like a car girl now. Like, I have a minivan that I drive everywhere, which is like,
I like minivans too.
Take the girl out of New York. My guy. My God, here she is. Okay. Yeah. By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily.
I'm Quinlan Parker.
And I'm Carrie Ipama. And we have one person to thank. The special. Let me go.
She gets her own episode. Are you ready?
Yeah. I gave it a drum roll.
Oh, I can't hear it when you do that.
Weird. Okay.
I know. It's like they take out our laughter sometimes too.
Shit. We got to figure that out.
It's really interesting. Just know that we're always laughing. When you hear silence, it's laughter.
But they're going to be so grateful for the lack of mouth noises. The thing is, here's the deal. Would you rather keep the mouth noises and take out the laughter, or keep the laughter, keep in the mouth noises? It's like, it's one or the other,
folks.
That's
a really good question.
One or the other.
You guys tell us.
Write in.
Sherry R.
Sherry. Sherry.
Sherry. Sherry. Oh,
Sherry, you are. I don't want to say Harry. I don't know. You could be Harry, or you could be.
You are scary, just like we are. That's why we're friends.
And a car.
Sherry, let's have a scary contest.
One, two, three.
Who is the winner?
Don't blink,
Sherry. Whoever loses, you will die. Just kidding, Sherry. I went too far. I was trying to add some drama to the song.
But it's now too long. We hope you enjoy this time with us, because we are so obnoxious. There it is.
Boop, boop, boop. Perfect. I also just want to shout out Subhub for giving us a really nice Apple review.
Hey,
thanks, Subhub.
Subhub
said that they heckin' love these weirdos. Great true crime podcast, excellent storytelling. If you have not left us a review on Apple, then my question for you is, what are you waiting for? The doctor says an apple a day.
That, and I got to tell you, we get, I think on Spotify we get reviews, and it's always really fun to check those and see what people are saying. And I guess I got a little flack. My cousin reached out to me too. I got a little flack a couple weeks ago because I said I auditioned for basketball. And people were like, wow, Carrie didn't even. Yeah. So in case you didn't know, if you're a new listener, I'm an actor, and I've never been good at sports in my life. So now that we're acquainted, I think we should get into some story time.
Yeah, let's do it.
So as many of you know, I am on tour with the show Psychology of Serial Killers, and I have been fortunate enough to be on stage and learn about serial killers every night. So there are certain serial killers we have not covered, and I'm going to cover them. And this one is pretty well known. It's Ed Kemper. Do you know Ed Kemper?
Oh my God. Yes. And Matt's friend plays him in that great show.
Mindhunter? Mm-hmm. No way. No.
Okay. I'm over characterizing their relationship, I think, when I call them friends, but I know that he knows that guy and I think went to school with him.
Oh, crazy. So what's important to know about the show that I'm in is she's a clinical psychologist. She's researched a lot of these guys. And so the show premise is that she has developed what she believes to be the formula for serial killers. So she is able to say, like, here's this thing that all serial killers share. And so she goes into it. So Ed Kemper is someone that, it's amazing, especially in California, because we actually drove by where he is currently. But like, there's a little video of him before she gets started, and people just really react very strongly to Ed Kemper. So I'm just going to get into a little bit about him. So, well, I was actually going to maybe try to do a reveal, but I don't think I should do a reveal. Maybe I should do...
I don't think you need to just because everybody knows Ed Kemper.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, should I start with his childhood or should I start with his crimes?
Yeah, do chronologically.
Okay.
Do a chrono.
I'll do a chrono. I got this from Wikipedia, all of that's interesting, and the show that I am currently in. So Ed Kemper is born 1948, and his dad is also named Edmund. He's a junior. Well, he's a third, actually. Which, by the way, I just have to note, interestingly
enough, only needed one, and we got three.
We got three. What I need to note, which is interesting, is that John Wayne Gacy was also named after his father.
And Illinois has an entire number about John Wayne Gacy, which was so surprising.
Oh my gosh, really? Spoiler alert.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, he's from Illinois, so John Wayne Gacy, that's where he was most, that's where he was active. I think it was like Peoria, or not Peoria, but I'm trying to think of where he was.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It felt a little left field in the piece, but at the same time.
It was right. Right up your alley is what it is. Let's mix up like bowling and baseball references. I love it. Okay.
Yeah.
So Ed's dad is a World War II vet, and he also tested nuclear weapons. He worked and then went on to a career as an electrician. And what's interesting about it is that Ed Kemper's father had said that while he was serving in the military, he said the suicide missions in wartime and the bomb testing, the atomic bomb testing, was nothing compared to living with his wife.
Oh, my God.
To put it into perspective.
Man with away with words.
Yeah, so
away with words.
Ed's mom, Clarnell, is that her name?
What a name, Clarnell.
Clarnell, and it's a kind of a cool name.
I have a friend whose mom's name is Trudell. And my mom's name is Raydell. Her name is Clarnell.
Clarnell, I don't think you should list your mom in this woman's company. I don't. I really don't. Because here's the deal about her. She's abusive. She was abusive. She was an alcoholic. When he was a baby, she said she didn't want to coddle him for fear that it would make him gay. She was incredibly abusive. So she would tell him from a young age that like no woman would ever love him. She might have borderline personality disorder, and maybe it all started when Ed was born. Ed was born at 13 pounds. So maybe she was just like really
Holy shit.
He's like big kid. Like at four, he was like
That's
a foot
double
tall.
Double Koa.
Yeah. No, he was huge. And he's always been big. Like he's 6'9", 300 pounds. Like he's always been a big guy. When Ed was four, his older sister apparently tried to kill him twice. Like she tried to push him in front of a train, and then also she threw him in the deep end of a pool. So he had like two near-death experiences. And at this time, he started like fantasizing about heads, and he would take his sister's Barbies and he would pop their heads off, imagining they were real women. So he was like starting to experiencing some like very dark ideations as a kid. There's also reports of him when he was young sneaking out of his home with his dad's bayonet to like go to his second grade teacher's house and watch her through her windows.
Why do you need the bayonet for that?
Because in case someone tried to attack him, I don't know, but like he would stalk his second grade teacher.
Just seems like an ingredient you didn't need it.
And like, listen, in the show, it's interesting. People ask about the McDonald triad. I'm sure you know about the McDonald triad. Do you know about the McDonald triad?
No. What is that?
It's a theory that if you have these three things, you could be a serial killer. So it's
hit on the head.
No. Is it hit on the head? No.
Torture animals.
Torture animals.
Bedwetter.
Bedwetter. And then what was the other one?
So close. I don't know.
Wait, I want to see what it
I'm
is.
Really close,
You're
though.
You're so close. Hold on. McDonald's triad. I want to do it because I want to make sure I like hear it every night, but sometimes, you know what? Triad.
Sometimes when you hear it every night, it just sounds like wah, wah, wah.
Oh, there it is. It's animal torture, bedwetting, and fire starting. And so the idea is that like this was like very early in the psychology of serial killers where like if you had all three, the chances of you being a serial killer was quite high. However, like not all serial killers fit into this formula. And also like you can have these formulas and not be a serial killer.
Right.
So here he is. He's at 10 years old and he's doing one of them. He's hurting animals. At 10 years old, he buries a cat alive.
Wow.
Later, he fantasizes about killing his older sister, so he decapitates her cat, and he mounts it on a spike. He kills yet another cat. So, like, we have animal torture Ed Kemper, and he was having increased visions and ideations of hurting people. One of his favorite games that he would play as a kid was electric chair or gas chamber, where he would be in a chair and his sister would flip a switch and he would pretend to convulse and die from the electric chair. So, like I said, his parents' relationship was not good because his mom was just like was very abusive. Ed's dad, not happy in the relationship, like did not love, would not recommend. He like wanted to do suicide missions and test the A-bomb as opposed to living with his wife. So It should come as no surprise, but I guess it should. It's 1957. People aren't getting divorced, but his parents separate. And so Ed does not live with his dad. He lives with his mother. Now, Ed is 8 years old, okay? Eight. He's living with his mom and his sisters, and his mom makes him move into the basement. Okay, he's a child. Because, quote, she doesn't want him raping his sisters.
What?
He is sent in the basement, and
he's
8 to 10. He's like between 8 and 10. He moves into the basement and he has like one of those like scary like light bulbs with a chain.
Yeah.
A cot.
He's in a dungeon.
And no windows. And he says at the time, he goes, it felt like she was sending me down to hell and her and my sisters were going up to heaven. Okay. She would mock him. She called him a weirdo. And like she just was relentless in how she treated him. So at 14, he decides he's going to run away and he's going to move in with his dad. So he goes to move with his dad. He gets to his dad's house and he realizes his dad is remarried. He has a step sibling and his stepmom, I can't blame her for this. She's like, I actually don't want him living in the house with me. Like at this point, he's like killed cats. She's like, I got a weird vibe from Ed. I don't want him in the home. So they trick him and they send him to his dad's parents. So his grandparents, grandma and grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
So he's hanging out with grandma and grandpa. And apparently, like, his grandma was a lot like his mother, where she was pretty manipulative. I don't know. She played the same head games as what has been told to me. What's interesting, though, is that this is his father's mother. So it's like, you know, you do marry your mother. I don't know. Anyway, so he's 15. He's sitting with his grandma. They get in a big fight. He leaves. He gets his grandfather's rifle. And he shoots her in the head and twice more in the back and kills his grandmother. Some accounts will go on to say that he stabs her body and he hears his grandfather coming in. And to, quote, spare him the sight of his dead wife, he goes out into the driveway and shoots and kills his grandfather. So he's killed both of his grandparents at the age of 15. He then calls his mother and he tells her what happened. And she says, call the police. So he hangs up with his mother. He calls the police. He tells them what happens. And he waits at the house to be taken into custody.
Yeah.
It is shown that he is psychotic, that he is not well mentally, in case that wasn't already clear. And he is put in a mental institution. It is there that he is diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And so he's institutionalized. He's committed. He starts working with doctors. And what's important to note is like, in these situations, in a very structured setting, he is thriving. They end up testing his IQ, and his IQ is 145. Like, he's brilliant. The psychologists there think he is essentially cured. He's seemingly very respectful. I think he appreciates authority and structure, where I think in his life he has none. And at 21, he's let out for good behavior. But the doctors tell him you can leave, but under no circumstances should you move in with your mom. So guess where he goes?
To his mom's.
And she is just as abusive as when he left. It's important to note that in 1972, his juvenile records are expunged with the murders of his grandparents. The last report from the doctor says, if I were to see this patient without having any history available or getting any history from him, I would think that we're dealing with a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illnesses. It is my opinion that he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or any member of society. And since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential, I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expunction of his juvenile records. So when I say a model patient, model patient.
Yeah, yeah. People were like, he's going to go on to do great
exactly.
things.
When he left and his record was expunged, he could pursue a dream that he's been wanting to reach his whole life. He wanted to be a police officer. He wanted to be a cop. But he was rejected. Do you know why he was rejected from the academy, from the police? You might think, was it because he murdered his grandparents? Silly Quinn. No. It's because he was too tall.
Oh, my God. I thought you might say that.
He was 6'9", and he was too tall.
They didn't have any uniforms that would fit him.
They're like, we can't deal with floods. We can't deal with capris on an officer. How tacky.
Yeah.
No. So he was known, but he still, like, really wanted to be a cop, and he would hang out at the local cop bar, and they called him a friendly nuisance, like he was just around. And he ended up going on to work for the State of California Division. He went on to work at the state, at California State's Division of Highways. So he knows the highways very well, and he buys himself a motorcycle, and at 24, he gets into a motorcycle accident. And with the settlement money, he buys this car that he starts trolling the highways and picking up hitchhikers.
Mm-hmm.
He starts picking up hitchhikers, and he's doing this thing where he would pick them up, drop them off. He starts to get a bit titillated. He starts to have these fantasies, and so he stocks his car.
Of what if I skip the drop-off
The dropping off part. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he fills his car up with plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs. And he says he picked up about 150 hitchhikers. And then he started to feel these urges that he called little zappers. It is 1972, and it is May 7th, and he picks up Marianne Pesch and Anita Leaches. They are students from Fresno State University, and they are wanting to go to Stanford. So they get a ride, and picks them up in his car, and he drives them for an hour before telling them, revealing that he is not taking them to Stanford, that he has rerouted, and he brings them to a secluded wooded area near Alameda. He handcuffs them.
What exactly did he say to them?
I think they didn't know that he changed directions, and he just stopped and was like, change of plans. He arrests them, and he puts them in the trunk of his car. This is worth noting. He later mentions that while he's handcuffing Marianne Pesci, he brushes his hand across her breast, and he feels embarrassed, and he apologizes to her. He's like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And it's not minutes later that he murders her.
Right.
Which is just...
There's like a really interesting division there, right?
Yes. It's like...
Which also speaks to him being a psychopath and also appearing as a really polite, mild-mannered rule follower.
I think
because
these people
feared
him.
Simultaneously exist as both.
Yeah, and I think it was him that said something to the extent of, like, when I would see a woman, I didn't know whether I wanted to take her out on a date or see her head on a spike. It was like this split self. And while he's committing these murders, he would go on to date someone, a young woman, and get engaged to her during this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's picking up these women.
It's a little Ted Bundy, a little bit.
It's a little Ted Bundy. He's like,
because he would date women and not hurt them.
Ted Bundy's interesting, and I can get into that more. I mean, he was, all of his victims look like Diane, you know, the woman he loved, who he ended up ghosting later on in life. And he would use like casts or bandages to make him look empathetic so that women would help him, and then he would abduct them. I think it was interesting, this like apology of brushing his hand against her breast is like, it's why he needed to kill his victims before he could sexually assault their bodies. I think he couldn't.
It's like too much.
It was like too much. Yeah. So and it's interesting the way the psychologist Rachel I'm working with talks about it is it's his mother's head games that are like, is this obsession with the decapitation, which all of his victims will be decapitated. So. He would shoot, smother, strangle, or stab his victims, and then he would take them back to his house. Now, what's important about these first two victims, Mary Ann and Anita, he killed them in this secluded area, put them in the trunk of his car. He had a broken taillight. While he was driving them back to his house, he got pulled over by a police officer. The police officer did not know there were any corpses in the trunk, and let him go.
Mm-hmm.
Just like how close these people are to being caught. If they caught him in the first one, we would have saved lives, right?
And the difference between somebody that's sweating at the wheel and probably able to maintain their composure.
Yeah. So he would take these bodies home and he would disrobe them, take photos of them, dismember them, sexually assault them in various ways, bury their remains. Over the next 11 months, he will go on to kill 6 hitchhikers, 5 of them women, college students, and one of them was a high school student. The high school student is next. Her name is Aiko Ku. She is 15 years old. She misses her bus after a dance class, and she hitchhikes a ride home. What's noteworthy about this one is that he pulls a gun on her and then locks himself out of his car. While the gun is in the car with her, she lets him back in. And he kills her.
Mm.
Cindy Shaw, she is 18 years old. He does the same thing to her. He kills her. He assaults her body, dismembers it. But this time, he takes her head and he buries it in his mother's garden, facing up at her window. Because as he says, my mother always liked people looking up to her. So he buried this woman's head looking up at his mother's.
Yeah.
At this time, people are recognizing the disappearance of all these women. He would target what he called privileged women, right? Those were the women that he would murder. Around this time, people were worried because they noticed that these women who were hitchhiking were disappearing. And the local university had said, hey, everybody, like, be on the lookout. These hitchhiking disappearances are occurring. So only get into a car if it has a university sticker. That was how they would sort of protect them. And Kemper was able to find a university sticker because his mom worked at UCSC.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
Yeah. Rosalind Thorpe, who's 23, Allison Liu, who was 20, two more women he murdered and assaulted. So that's his 6 victims, right? That he's picked up in this 11-month period. And then he picks up 2 new hitchhikers. And from what he says is they look almost identical to his first 2 victims, Marianne and Anita. And something in him just snapped, or I guess a light bulb went on, and he said, this has to stop. This has to stop. So he drops these final 2 women off at their location, and these 2 women have no fucking clue that
they got out and had no idea. Obviously.
Yeah. And what's worth noting is like a lot of the women could not escape because what he would do is these women would come in and he would essentially like rig the door with a chapstick so they couldn't get out. And he would like do it sneakily so that they couldn't leave the car when he stopped it. So these 2 women get out of the car not knowing that they were in the car with Ed Kemper, which is just absolutely shocking to me. It's a week later that he walks into his mother's room while she is sleeping and he takes a claw hammer and he bludgeons her to death. He decapitates her, he removes her tongue and larynx, and he puts it down the garbage disposal. He assaults her head, he puts it on a mantle, and he yells at her head for over an hour. He throws darts at it, and then he smashes it in. After this, he goes out, has a drink, comes back to his mother's home, invites a friend over, kills her friend by strangulation, leaves this note at the scene, says approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday, no need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents, just a lack of time. I got things to do. He then drove to Pueblo, Colorado, which was a 1,000-mile journey. He took caffeine pills to stay awake. Once he got there, he found a phone booth. He calls the police. He admits to everything, and he says the original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was a pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Toward the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing, and at the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it all off. He would later reflect that the women he would murder, his victims, would come after particularly difficult fights with his mother. A lot of psychologists have said that there is a deep connection between his relationship with his mother and his victims, and that at the end of the day, these were surrogates for the woman he really wanted to attack was his mother. In total, he killed 10 people, including his grandparents at the earlier part of the story. At his trial, he tried to plead insanity. While in custody, he tried to commit suicide twice. They did find him legally sane. He was found guilty on all accounts. He has asked for the death penalty. He requested death by torture, but California had a moratorium on capital punishment, so he got...
Yeah, they're also like, yeah, you don't just get to be like, here's how I want to go.
He's a very interesting case, right?
Completely.
Like, he turns himself in.
And he's, like, very clear on, like,
why
I decided,
he did it. Yeah.
No, this has to stop.
Yeah.
Then I did this. Then I did this. What's the drive about?
What do you mean?
The drive to Pueblo. Why?
I think he probably was in, like, a state. I think he probably
like a,
just was, like...
a manic.
I think he is, what he wanted to do was he wanted to kill his mom's friend and, like, stage it. And I think by the time he got there, he was like, that's it. I'm out. Like, I think he killed his... Because there's no information about if he did anything horrid, abuse his mom's friend's body, right? So it's like he just kills her and leaves. And so I think maybe he hoped he would go on the run, go on the lam, but he ends up turning himself in, being like, I'm done. I'm out. This is over. He gets 7 years to life for each count. What's interesting is while he's in prison, he, again, like at the psychiatric ward early in his life when he was 15, he becomes a model prisoner. You know, it's like he just needed structure and someone to tell him what to do and not to be abusive towards him, right? He has one infraction for failing to give a pee sample in 2016. But while he's in prison, he channels his whatever he's feeling and he now makes these ceramics, which I'm sure people have heard about, that are beautiful. Like he channels his work into art. He would read audiobooks for the blind. He led the volunteer effort to reading books for the blind while he's in prison. Every time parole would come up, he would deny parole. He's been interviewed for a movie called, I think, The Killing of America. And his hope is to maybe like stop it from happening to anybody else or to... It just feels like...
What? It's so wild.
Yeah.
It also is like this thing where if that's real...
Mm-hmm.
And he had never been abused, who would he have become? You can't help but wonder.
It's hard because I think in the show, I think she, our psychologist, has a lot of, she sees good in everyone, right? I think her whole thing is she's trying to realize these, what people refer to as monsters, these serial killers, what made them into who they are, you know? And the things that she has found in her formula is they all come from horribly abusive upbringings. They were bullied. They have a paraphilia that was activated from a young age, which is a image of a thing, a situation, or an activity, which is, for example, like Jerry Brutus, which I'll cover later, is the shoe fetish slayer. From a young age, his obsession with shoes, and it became sort of his modus. I didn't mention this, but like when he was a teenager, he went to a magic show and saw someone get decapitated in a guillotine magic. Mm-hmm. And it became so titillating to him. And like I said, he was popping the heads off of Barbies, but like this decapitation theme is happening. And Rachel says it's because of his mother's head games. But I think what's interesting about it is looking at, he's just, I find him so fascinating just because of like what he has done in prison and how he doesn't want to be back out. And he even says like, obviously he's in his 70s now and he's nearly blind. He had a stroke. So he's probably, you know, pretty incapable of doing what he did before. But a lot of times serial killers will get arrested and they'll say, why did you do it? And they'll say, I was hoping you could tell me that. It's like they don't know. They're addicts, essentially. They're addicted to killing. And once you get that first high, you just have to chase it, right? Mm-hmm. That's her theory. That's her. But at the end of the day, it's like you have these 10 victims and their poor families. And it's not any comfort to these people to know that this guy is doing well in prison while their family was tortured or was murdered. You know, we cover a lot of serial killers and there's a difference between sadists and what Ed did, I think Ed killed these women quickly. And what he did to their bodies is grotesque and disgusting and morally reprehensible. I find him fascinating, the psychology of him, of of him flourishing in these institutional settings, whereas when he was left to his own devices, he was obviously capable of just horrific, horrific things.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, do you have any questions? Did I explain that okay, or is there...
No, that was great. I feel like I... Do I have any questions? I think I'm just overwhelmed by that story. Like, I just sort of can't help... This is the first time I've really felt like this is like two people coexisting in a body.
Yeah, the shadow self. And,
but he's not, he's not got multiple personalities. It's more just to say, like, I don't think, you know, I don't find him, for whatever reason and whatever I've seen on him depicted in television shows and this kind of thing, which is obviously not reality. But and every time I hear the story, I just am left believing him, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I don't often feel that way. Like, I think that often serial killers or killers in general, they're in it for themselves. And so when they say something, it's to benefit themselves. And I'm just always weirded out by him because I'm like, I believe you. And I think it's so crazy that you like just were like, that's enough.
The fact that he stops it, and like these two women that looked like his first victim, it just was this aha moment of like, I'm going to stop. There's a study that she quotes in the show that I want to share with you because I find it so compelling, fascinating, where it's, and I actually don't know if Ed Kemper was sexually assaulted, but I know that in many serial killers, there is evidence of sexual abuse from a young age. With this study, they look at boys who experience sexual abuse and women and girls who experience sexual abuse, and they find that boys who experience sexual abuse tend to go towards sadism later in life. And with girls who experience sexual abuse, they go towards masochism in their life. And I'm drawn to the, do you remember the story you told on Crime of a Lifetime of the woman who was stalking herself? What was her name?
Ruth
Finley.
Yeah.
Ruth Finley. You told the story of Ruth Finley. And Ruth Finley dealt with absolutely horrific abuse growing up, and how it manifested later in life was she would dissociate and she became her own abuser.
She tried to hurt herself.
And she actually hurt herself. She stabbed herself.
Yeah.
She was able to disassociate enough where she could stab herself, which is an impossible thing to do, right? I think what's interesting is if we look at how these male serial killers exist after abuse with sadism is like you can see, and again, I don't know if it's nature nurture, so if it's like a sociological thing that men can express it with sadism where women tend to hurt themselves, right? So I just find it fascinating in this situation, that's the case study of like, because it, you know, I think looking up at Ruth Finley is she hurt herself primarily. But if someone were to go towards sadism, they would hurt others. And I think that's, I don't know, I just think there's like a parallel to be drawn there between the abuse he experienced. I just also am like, that report from the psychologist that he was, or the psychiatrist that he was, that wanted to expunge his record feels so chilling to me, of being like, this guy's like, seems like,
this guy's great.
He's great.
He's going to do great things.
Yeah.
Leave him alone.
Yeah.
He went out and beheaded a million girls.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really wild.
And the apology, too. The apology for brushing up against his victim before he murdered her. Like, that's the other thing that is just, the psychology of it is so fascinating. Sorry, I could go on talking for hours. So I,
but it's so interesting.
We have to, I mean, yeah, I'm sure I'll learn
more
about
it.
We have to move on. It's time for you to tell your story. I hope it's uplifting. And I do think, like, anyway. Okay, let's pause for ad.
I'm going to tell you the story of Cynthia Anderson. This is from Cold Case Explorations, spoiler alert, and Unsolved Mysteries, double spoiler alert. Sorry, but you're not going to get an answer today. But I do want to talk about it because I'm sure a lot of you have heard this story. I'm fascinated by it. Cynthia was born February 4th, 1961, and her family was a strict religious Christian fundamentalist family. And I saw her dad in the Unsolved Mysteries describe her as quiet and obedient. He was like, a happy child, just what you'd want in a daughter, lovely. And I was like, I don't know why that spooks me, but it does.
It does. It gives me the heebie-jeebies.
He's like, she was never a problem. You know, and you're like, ooh. In 1980, she's a young woman now, and she is having very strange, vivid dreams. In these dreams, she goes to a door, and there's a man at the door, and she recognizes the man. When she wakes up, she will not be able to say who that man is, but she knows she has the feeling of, I know you.
Okay.
She opens the door to him, and then he goes after her. Like, betrays her, essentially, and it flips, and she is then running from him, trying not to get murdered by him.
Okay.
Whoever this person is. And she has this dream. I said it's reoccurring. She has this dream frequently, all the time. Enough so that we know she had it because she tells people about it. She's dreaming it for like a year, and she tells her mom about it. Her sister overhears her talking about it. And we now are at a point in Cynthia's life where she's looking forward to the future. She's going to quit her job in 2 weeks, and the plan is that she and her boyfriend are going to go to college, and she's super excited. It's a big shift. And on August the 4th of 1981, 20 years old, she goes to work like she always does. She's a secretary at a law office, and her deal at the office is that she arrives there early before anybody, and when she goes in, she locks the door behind her. Not only that, but there's also a buzzer that she has on her desk that would ring an alarm at the neighboring store and
right.
let them know. Like, basically, it sounds like a lot of security
right.
is all I'm saying. But when the lawyers arrive at work that morning after her, they show up. The door's locked. The lights are on. They go in. She's not there. When she leaves the office ever, she always puts the phones on hold because she's not going to be there to pick them up. So it's like a button that you're like, that button has not happened. So she didn't think she was leaving, but she has left. They then go into another room of the office and they see the book that she's been reading, which is a romance novel. The book is earmarked to a page that is the only violent scene in the book, and it is a scene about a girl being held at knife point. The lawyer feels sick when he sees this, and he can't explain why, but he's just like, this is off. This doesn't make sense. No one ever sees her again, ever. That's the mystery. No one has ever, ever seen Cynthia Anderson ever again, and that happened in 1981. So that's our mystery. The big debate and the big sort of thing that makes people talk about this is that everyone knows about these dreams, and it feels really wild that it some people will be like, maybe she was like ruminating on leaving, maybe she was running away, but this dream of somebody coming to a door and her knowing them and opening it for them and it going wrong,
the locked and the
it just feels like it happened.
Okay.
It feels like her dream happened. So people are like, what in the world? For a year, her body knew this was going to happen. It's just very odd. During the course of their investigation, they figure out that she stopped answering the phones after 10 a.m. So they're basically like, we think she was abducted before 10. And they go to the family and they're like, did you notice anything weird leading up to this?
After 10, right? She was abducted after 10. If she stopped answering the phones at 10.
At 10.
So between 10, she was abducted after 10.
Yeah, around 10.
Thank you. Because you were like, she was abducted before 10. And I was like, I think
at that moment, basically. Yeah. They can like time it out.
Yeah.
So they go to her parents and they're like, was anything weird? And her dad's like, I did notice that she was super interested, I thought, lately in her appearance. Like spending a lot more time on her hair and her makeup mm-hmm. and wanting to lose weight. And so that's not a huge deal, but I think that
any changes in behavior, like, you're like, what's going on? Is she
And you're like, was there a new secret guy in your life?
Right.
That wasn't your boyfriend right. that you were going to quit the job and go to college with? Was there a new guy that you like kind of just, not that you were even with him, but that you wanted to look good in front? We just don't know the answer to that. There was no sign of a struggle. Her car was there right in front of the office. Her bank account and social have never been used since that day. So you do think this person is not undercover somewhere. They're dead.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you just think they would be killed. The other,
I think she booked it. I think she booked it.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. So far,
the escape the life. Okay, I'm going to give you this because
I don't because there's no.
Thing.
There's
okay,
no
let me give you this.
Jostling of the place, right? Like everything
no,
is.
No, there's no jostling. There's no jostling. And she
you can
had
quote
to,
us on that. There's no jostling.
No one broke in. No jostling. No one broke in. She had to open the door for whoever it was.
But it's locked as she left. Like, is there any other exit in that place besides the front door where she entered?
No, I don't believe so. Let me tell you another thing. 10 months before this happens, the way her office is situated is across the street. There's like a big, there's like construction mm-hmm. in a way that they have boards up like Post No Bills style.
Yeah.
And on that board, somebody graffitis it and it says, I love you, Cindy, by GW. And it's across the street on the construction. Nobody thinks it's necessarily aimed at her or anything, but it is that feeling of looking out your window and it's very prevalent mm. and your name is Cindy. So there is that feeling of it's graffiti and Cindy's a common name, but it does also feel like
did she go by Cindy?
Right out. Yes.
Okay.
But it's right out my window. Is it to me? Is it a secret admirer? That seems odd. And after being there for 6 months, they came and painted over it. And then the next day, it was there even larger. So it was very
okay.
intentional.
Okay.
And, you know, we know about it because she also talked to her friends about it. And they were all, we cannot think of who GW would stand for. We can't think of it. The maintenance man that worked the building has keys to the building. So he was investigated, but they didn't find any evidence it could have been him. But who knows? I mean, I don't know.
What does her family think?
They don't know. They don't know. But they, you know what they'll say? The sister will say she seemed really like excited for her future. She did not seem like someone that was about to run away.
But was she excited about her future because it was with a new guy?
I don't know. There was a client that came into the law office the day before. He had to come in to pay a fee and he saw her get a phone call and the way she reacted was like it was a prank call or something, but that thing where like your face kind of flushes and you just hang up and he's like, are you okay? And it happens like twice while he's there that she gets this call and she looks really scared sort of.
Yeah.
That hanging up and he's like, are you okay? She's like, oh yeah, it's been happening lately. And she seems scared enough that him watching her, he called the police when he got home and was like, you should check in on her. Because that was weird.
Whoa. Okay.
Because like it felt like somebody was calling and doing like a weird thing. We don't know if they were saying something creepy or just hanging up and she was weirded.
But there's like no duress.
But that happened the day before. Okay. Another thing. They later get a call anonymously. A woman. She's scared. She calls and she says, I'm calling about Cynthia Anderson. She's being held by someone. She's being held in the basement of a white house. I can't tell you the address. She sounds really scared. They're like, give us more info. Give us the address. She hangs up. She calls again. And she's like, I'm calling about Cynthia. Again, it's like a hang up call, but she basically says that there are two houses side by side owned by the same family. The parents are out of town. The son is home and he's the person holding Cindy and then hangs up. They do not ever find what this house is or what she's talking about.
Do they like cross-reference it with a GW? Or like, I bet it's George Washington. I bet it's like another president name. I bet it's like John Adams. I bet he's like... I feel like
pretty
my
odd.
Theory thus far is...
Her family's theory is that she has amnesia. Their want.
Right.
Wannabe theory.
Right.
They're like, she has amnesia and she's somewhere and she's happy. And you're like, that would be the best outcome.
I hope that... I grant them peace with that. I am curious if she did have an affair, was changing her hair, all this stuff. And this person, GW, was like writing love letters to her. And then it got to be too much. And she was breaking up with him. And he called. And she's freaked out because he's calling her. And then it escalates. And maybe he abducts her.
That presumes that she would have opened the door for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in November of 1995, years and years, 14 years, I think, after, her employer, Richard Neller, and one of his friends, Jose Rodriguez Jr., get indicted. It turns out they were running a drug distribution ring in Toledo.
Holy Toledo. So,
that's a big enough deal that then the police are like, okay, new theory. Maybe she heard too much at work about this drug ring, and maybe she got killed. And then when Rodriguez goes to trial for the drug ring stuff, a witness says, I also heard him confess to killing her, and that he killed her to send a message to his lawyer for not representing him properly during the previous trial, who worked with her, like at the firm. But nobody knows if that confession is legit. People knew this woman was dead. Neither Rodriguez nor or Neller, like nobody got charged. It's not official at all. But there was a lot of chitter chatter about, could it be related to knowing something about this drug ring? Could it have been used to as a weaponized thing against one another?
Has she been declared dead yet?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would say probably not, but I don't know. Right. I know that it's been, you know, it's been over 40 years.
It's just like no one just disappears.
No one thinks she ran away. People think she's dead. People think she's dead. Another thing that happened in the summer of 1981 is that these guys, Anthony and Nathaniel Cook, did 9 murders in Toledo, these brothers. That's true. They have been asked. They're like, no, we don't know about that one. Obviously not the most reliable narrators.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Just you get to a point where you're just like circling anything that could be it. But it's possible. It's possible they abducted and killed her. It's possible. But that doesn't totally, I mean, I hate to use her dream as evidence, but it doesn't fit the dream. But nor does it really fit that she would just open the door for
just
two strangers.
I can't co-sign the dream. I can't do it.
I know. I just think it's so interesting because she told people over and over about the dream before this happened, over and over and over.
Jesus.
And the dog-eared book is so weird. Just the oddest bit of evidence left behind that are like very cryptic, that almost points to, that leads you to believe she did run away because it feels so stagey. Like, I'm dreaming I'm going to get abducted.
Yeah, the fact that she's like, that's what I'm saying. Is like, she's like, hey, everybody, these dreams are so significant. These dreams are so, like, I don't know. How does everybody know about these dreams?
She's telling everybody.
And
about
do you remember all your dreams? That's it.
This is a recurring dream, which some people have.
I know.
Some people do have those. And a lot of people think they're tied to
her poor family.
Past lives or anything.
Was there any?
Her family's dead now. Her parents are dead now. And she'd be 63. So.
Oh, my God.
It's definitely in the category of cold case unsolved for sure. But it's a really interesting one because the evidence left behind is so bizarre.
It's like, and we can't even get DNA because unless she commits a crime or something, like there's no, I mean, where are people even like, I know we have like a big world. Okay. I know it's a big world, but like, have people really not stumbled upon a body part? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, what is going on? Is it that big? It's big.
It is, because I listen to a lot of these cold cases and so many of them are like, the body's never found. And you are left without a doubt that there is a body. But I just don't think it's as hard as we would hope it would be to hide a body.
Jesus. Oh, God. Okay.
Well, that's the story.
Thanks for telling it.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
I have a suggestion.
Thank you.
Go bowling. Go bowling.
How was bowling?
And I just went and it was so fun.
You got 69.
I got 69 twice. And once was because the game short fused and ended because we ran out of time 2 frames before.
And you had
69. So really,
69.
I got 69 twice and it was like,
who was the best bowler?
Wild.
Who was the best bowler?
Matt was the best bowler. I mean, no, there were strangers there that we didn't know that were the best bowlers, but Matt was the best bowler between me and Matt. And that's
did
what
he break
counts.
100?
Yes.
I never know.
I think most do, I have to
not
say.
Not me. Hey. Not,
69 is
not me.
Pretty, you know, I was warming it, but I was like, this is really smart because it was a party where people didn't know each other. And I just couldn't believe the structure of that is because you know how Larry David says you got to have like the referee step in to conversations. Have you heard that theory?
No. Tell me.
Oh, basically, he thinks that there should be a person hired to be at parties where if you see somebody stuck in a conversation that they're clearly like figuring out how to get out of, the person would walk up to who they're talking to and be like, you're done now. You're done. Like kind of like a conversation bouncer and like get people away from you.
Yeah.
Just in the name of like awkwardness and having to step away. And I agree that, like, the problem with having a party at a bar or something is you start to talk to somebody and then it's this thing of, like, it's very awkward to be like, okay, now I'm going to move on to a different person. You have to sort of be like, I'm going to get another drink, or I'm going to go to the bathroom, or you have to invent something just not even because you're having a bad conversation. It's just maybe you hit the 20-minute mark with that person and there's other people at the damn party. It just could be anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So bowling, you get into a conversation with somebody, you are going to max out at 5 minutes. One of you is going to have to get up to bowl. And then you either re-enter that conversation or you talk to somebody else or they start talking to somebody else when you get up to bowl. It's the least amount of pressure I have ever felt at a party where I didn't know people.
Wait, it was that's great.
Amazing. It was amazing.
I really like that.
And we were strangers, but we were like, oh, yay, like rooting for each other, like having like little moments of victory and loss that were like,
hot tip.
People were like laughing at themselves. I was like, this
go bowling
is genius.
Was it a birthday party?
It was. It was a 40th birthday.
I wish I liked bowling more, but that's, I really like.
No, it doesn't matter. You don't need to understand that this is the perfect party structure and we all need to embrace it from here on out. Every party, a bowling party. And that's my platform for 2024.
Where did you bowl?
Melody Lanes, of course.
Where's that?
Have you never been?
Where is it?
It's a trashy bowling alley in like a Sunset Park.
Never been there.
Oh my God. It's amazing. And I'm so sorry to tell you that Peter, the ancient bartender that worked there and has gray mutton chops, just retired. And he wears like an old timey bartender outfit. And he's like exactly what you want in time travel.
He looks like you're a
energy.
Skeleton bar guy that I always see when I do laundry in your basement. Like it scares the shit out of me. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Well, Melody Lanes, I got to go. I got to hit it up.
Well, next birthday party, I'm telling you.
Dear readers, we love you. This has been amazing. I missed recording with you, Quinn.
Let's hang out again soon.
Hey, we'll see you next week.